Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Your podcast for you.
And antiques.
Mostly those.
This week, we are going to be responding to two New York Times articles titled, respectively, How Low Will Antiques Market Actually Go?
Deeply offensive.
And When the Antiques Have to Go?
Even more offensive. Incredibly offensive topics both.
Dee, would I be remiss in saying that you have extremely strong feelings about the opinions espoused in these articles?
Well, yes. You would be most correct, my good sir.
The central thesis of How Low Will Market for Antiques Actually Go is that since the year 2000, the antiques market has fucking plummeted.
That's true.
And by plummeted, I mean several noteworthy New York City antiques dealers have switched over to modern shit almost exclusively.
And of course many have closed.
Yes. I personally wasn't aware that antiques were so fucking cheap now. Mostly because I'm a millennial and the difference between something selling for $10,000 versus something selling for $1,000 is, nothing because both are unaffordable.
Well, I hate to disabuse you of this notion, but, like, the first impression I had from both articles was, like, what are you talking about?
Really?
I don't understand what the fuck they're talking about, like, to put it mildly.
What are they talking about?
I have never in my long career doing this seen a piece dip from 10,000 to 1,000. That doesn't happen. Obviously, yes, antiques are, they are fractions of their former value, but I don't think these people are in touch with reality. And I think this is the sort of, like, this is the result you get when you only ever talk to the ultra rich.
Oh, is that the key?
Yeah, it's like, well, I can't sell it for $40,000, million, $100,000 anymore, so it's basically worthless. They seem to think that the strata was only in the 10,000s and is now never exceeding 1,000, which couldn't be, like, more reprehensibly simplified. I've been to a lot of small, medium, and large antique shops, and I'm pleased to say the gradient of prices has followed according.
To cite some specific examples from the New York Times, a 2002 set of 8 George III style carved mahogany chairs sold for $8,000. In 2016, a similar set of 8 chairs sold for $350.
Key word, similar set.
Oh.
What that means is there was actually a value difference, but I mean, I don't know this for certain. There's potentially an actual value difference. If the first set had some sort of interesting provenance, that would have actually made them more valuable.
Okay, so perhaps it is difficult to conduct this sort of hard data antiques experiment because antiques is difficult to create a control group for?
Exactly.
Unless you're selling the exact same item again?
Precisely. Because what you're not giving us in that, like, well, not you, obviously you didn't write this, but they're not
no,
giving
us... No, me personally.
You! You've done this, and I can't believe it. What you're not getting there is what the established baseline is. You can compare two things all day, but comparing two things doesn't tell you what the, like, what the average price is. I can't help but notice that they've left out the concept of an average, which is how most things are determined, period, all the time when it comes to numbers. You don't ever go by lowest and highest. Like, yeah, I have seen a thing sell for $2,000, I've seen a thing sell for $5, and they have been in similar shape and color, but that doesn't mean, like, oh, so it exists between $2,000 and $5. No! There's a median, and it has not provided a median, which makes those figures, I think that they are, I'm gonna say it, I think they're being manipulated slightly for effect. I don't think this article would have sold as well if they said they used to be 30,000, but now they're only 9,000.
I don't remember enough from statistics to refute that.
I don't think it's statistics. I don't know anything. I think everyone who knows me knows that my absolute weakest point is math, but I actually feel pretty confident saying that providing 2 points of data isn't enough to mark a trend.
Meanwhile, in 2003, again according to the New York Times, a Regency Breakfront bookcase sold for $9,500, whereas in 2016, an equivalent piece sold for $1,300.
It's that word, equivalent. Like, that's so vague.
You don't believe they are equivalent.
I think I'd want to be proven that they were equivalent. If you give me 2 breakfronts and one from Marlena Dietrich's goddamn estate, like, duh.
So your theory is that the higher priced items may have had either come from a more famous owner or just in general had better provenance than the lower selling items?
Or even, like, condition? like, variation in, like, color or design.
Is that not implied by the word equivalent?
No.
Okay.
Here's the thing, is I don't know. They didn't, like, the concept of equivalency is, like, based on what? Equivalent in condition? Equivalent in age? Equivalent in design? Equivalent in provenance? And again, what's the median price for a Regency Breakfront?
12 entire dollars.
Well, here's the thing. We've been selling Regency Breakfronts for in the 2,000 to 3,000 range for quite a while, so 1,000 isn't actually an enormous drop-off. So, like, again, like, it seems there's a context that I feel has been removed.
It might represent a more significant drop-off in the New York City market,
which is notoriously inflated in every, like, way it can be. Like, obviously none of this is statistical knowledge, but I think it would be pretty easy to say and be fairly accurate that things just are kind of more expensive in New York.
This is the first time I'm hearing of it.
Yes. Real estate, notoriously cheap.
And funnily enough, real estate is the topic of the second article, which is how when the antiques have to go is when you're selling your house or apartment or basically moving anywhere and want to convince someone else to move in there. Because I guess antiques are just extremely unappealing in this modern age.
Hey, do you want to hear my broad strokes on why I think that article's bullshit?
Please.
I don't think it's antiques that make people not want your shit.
No?
No, I think nobody wants to buy a house that's full of your stuff, regardless of the caliber of stuff that's in it, because it's yours and not theirs.
Ooh.
Put it, I don't know if you've heard of, like, the pod storage unit, but, like, I don't understand. The whole article is baffling because it, like, hinges on this idea that either they stay in the house forever or you sell them, which is wild because I usually put them in boxes and move them. Well, it's just, oh, I don't like their blender. I'm not going to buy their apartment. People do know that there's an in-between phase between, like, not owning it ever again and not having it immediately in a house you're not going to live in, right? And why does this article treat it like there's only two? Again, we're looking at two extremes.
So these articles were published about a year apart, one in spring 2018, the other in spring 2019. And it's funny because in the first article, they bring up how a new generation of homeowners may be rebelling against the preferences of their elders. I feel like there's an alternative explanation, and it's that we don't have any money.
That was the, all right, underneath the idea that, like, the idea that you either never see it again, or I guess never see it again because it stays in the house, apparently, is the idea that, like, there is so much, like, navel-gazing in both these articles, and I actually am going to say, like, every single article about interior design for the last 5 years, that doesn't seem to take into account that, like, things are expensive. Like, it brings up IKEA. Both of them bring up IKEA more than once, which is wild because, like, when I think IKEA, I don't think it's necessarily the design, but probably the rock bottom prices for useful pieces of furniture.
Yes.
Like,
I have never been motivated to go to IKEA because I think it looks good.
Yeah, it's not like, oh, that's so pretty. It's more like, well, I can't get a couch for $100 anywhere else.
The reason why I bring that point up now is because the reason the modern generation might also not be buying antiques is because we don't want to lug huge, heavy pieces through multiple apartment moves.
Well, that's the other thing is antiques are absolutely associated with, like, a homeowner thing.
Yes.
Like, they're for people who settle in. People who have apartments, you might notice, especially if you're one of them, that, like, the number of, like, beautiful heritage pieces that you have are nil. Because you might actually be used to throwing everything out when you move.
Or disassembling it.
Or disassembling it because you got, like, click-clack furniture. Because it's cheap and effective for what you need. Because you might be out in a year.
Or just having a bunch of really small pieces of furniture because, one, they fit in your house, and two, you can pick up and move them by yourself.
Could you imagine being, like, so blind to, like, the realities of the general, like, culture and society that we're living in that you would actually, like, look down at your feet and say, well, it must just be that they don't like their parents. Like, and it's got nothing to do with, like, the monstrous recessions, the absolute refusal of, like, wages to go up, the, like, increasingly nomadic, like, sort of apartment lifestyle. None of that could possibly be a reason for this.
Because, like, here's the thing. I would love to fill my house with beautiful dark Victorian pieces. Giant, heavy, ornate pieces. But I can't because I might have to move in a year, and I can't afford to buy any of it in the first place, much less move it from one location to another.
I cannot tell you how many pieces that I... affordable. Like, the other thing is that there are affordable pieces. I have turned them down solely on the idea that eventually I will have to move them. I can't have a marble top anything because I cannot afford movers to move my marble top anything. Like, it's not feasible. And it's not because I hate mom and dad and because grandma really, really set me off on the French. Actually, yeah. Well, she did, but the people, not the furniture.
But like, yeah, I'm not refusing to buy antiques because I hate my parents. I'm refusing to buy antiques because the people helping me move is my dad and his truck.
Yeah, and particle board weighs about 90 pounds less.
Yeah, I'm not going to make my father move black walnut.
It's that thing. I think we've brought it up like time and time again where they're refusing to think about the practicality of the stuff that they're talking about. Other point. Noticed in a lot of those articles, they talk to almost strictly interior designers, which is interesting. Because last time I checked, they're the ones who set the trends. So there's something very wild to me about saying, you should get all of the antiques out here and paint it white because that's what people want. To people who don't otherwise believe that. And then saying, well, I just don't know why they don't want the antiques. Possibly because your entire industry has been telling them that they can't. It's a lot. Like, it's a lot. Could you imagine if the queen of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of like major influencers and I live in a box. So I don't.
Instagram, the whole thing.
Imagine if Belle Delphine was like,
yes.
Listen, one Instagram influencer I know.
A lot of my life choices have been influenced by Belle Delphine. Yes. Belle Delphine, if she told you to buy antiques.
Well, if Belle Delphine tomorrow made like an Instagram post that became the most important Instagram post of all time, saying like, I hate having furniture in a room, only white walls, and perhaps a tatami mat. And then, like, the next day, when everyone, like, you know, there's articles and magazines and everything talking about that the empty room tatami mat look. But then Belle Delphine got on, like, a week later, and she was like, I just don't understand why people don't like having things in their room. Which is, you did that. You are at least in part responsible for the change that was made. I'm sorry to say, but influence is reality.
In your mind, interior designers are not responding to customer demand. They are creating customer demand.
I think they're shaping customer demand. I think saying either of the other two is a little too strong in either direction. But like, I do think that they have a lot of say in the process of what becomes hip, right? Like fashion designers.
See, my theory has always been that interior design works like most other art forms in that the thing you want to create in your heart will likely never be what the public wants. And you are indeed at the whim of other people's taste for your entire career.
Almost certainly, yes.
So I'm not sure they are necessarily in the position of taste maker.
It's possible. Maybe I'm saying this too much like it's a point of fact. I think that either is likely. I know so many interior designers who get most of their shopping done at antique stores.
Could that possibly be because you've worked in antiques for 14 years and most of the people you've met have been in an antique store, so you are more likely than not to meet the interior designers that use antiques in your work than you are to meet the interior designers that don't use antiques in their work?
Possibly, yes. That's all true. I'm just saying, I can't write it out. I can't write out the possibility that there is, in fact... Well, because the people in the articles and all that, they are not your neighborhood interior designers. These are, like, big names up and coming in the magazines, which means they occupy a different space.
Okay. So, the kind of interior designers that the New York Times interviews are the kind who get to make tastes, yes, rather than chain themselves to tastes.
Exactly. It's like, Damien Hirst... All right, we're gonna get artsy. Damien Hirst did not appeal to anybody on his own merits. He had enough money to make people go, oh, that cost a lot of money. And as a result, he changed the art market pretty significantly. But not because anyone had any particular affinity for his work or that there was a real demand. It's because he created a demand because he made money.
Listen, I respect that, but I also think a giant taxidermy shark in a tank is dope as hell.
It's literally his only good piece. It's the only one. Damien Hirst, fight me in a real life.
Please.
You're talking about a man who said his medium was money. And like, obviously those people that occupy that space are setting... how long did Damien Hirst and Jeff Koons, they, like, make what was contemporary art, like, what you could buy and sell? Ages!
longer than I was paying attention to contemporary art, for being totally
honest. Well, exactly, yeah. And so, yeah, yes, I do think that, like everything else, there are levels. And I don't think the New York Times is piddling around with, you know, your dear sweet auntie who genuinely has a good sense for design. I don't think that the New York Times is asking her opinion. Because she would probably say something about rustic charm and color and space.
Speaking of rustic charm, there was a distinctly flea market flip note about the whole coverage of antiques in the New York Times.
Oh, you highlighted the bits that made me mad, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
Before I even showed you the article.
Well, because you knew. I'm very good at broadcasting.
I read these articles and I could hear you screaming in my head, so I highlighted some passages.
Don't paint anything white. Stop it.
Or, to quote the New York Times, one solution, paint it. Especially if we're not dealing with the precious antiques, sometimes it can really be elevated with a coat of paint, Mr. Carter said. That being Mr. Carter of Daryl Carter, a interior decorating business in Washington, D.C. The other thing is, if you put white leather on an antique chair, suddenly it's quite modern.
Well, that's the only part I don't have a problem with, like, upholstering a chair is very easy.
Really? You don't have a problem with reupholstery?
No, I have no problem with reupholstery.
Okay.
My personal opinion, this is all purely emotional, The nature of an upholstered piece is to change with the time.
Is that because upholstery is so much more difficult to preserve than wood?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fabric is ephemeral, so it makes a certain kind of sense that that piece could host numbers of upholstery over the years. And because upholstering, it doesn't change anything intrinsic to it, you know, the structure will always be the same. I will come for you if it's tufted and you take the tufts out.
How dare you?
You monster. Because it's never getting put back.
That said, I do really want a t-shirt that says fabric is ephemeral.
How ironic will it be when that t-shirt wears holes in it, though?
Exactly. It's art.
Oh, that's the ultimate hipster wear.
It's art.
I think Damien Hirst just, like, did a backflip off a balcony somewhere.
God, if only.
Yeah, yeah. I think upholstery is one of the few things you can, like, have fun with if you want to, like, change a look of something.
Paint, on the other hand.
No, paint will ruin it. If you need to change it that badly, then you don't want it. Like, I don't know what to tell you. And we've been over many times that there is a difference between painting a perfectly good piece of furniture and painting, like, if it's junky and all of the veneers rotten off and, you know, that's a different animal entirely. But if you're just looking at it and going, oh, I would love it if it were entirely different, then just go buy something else.
Now, Mr. Carter does take pains to point out that this applies if you're not dealing with the precious antiques, which I assume is New York City interior designer, or rather Washington, D.C. interior designer code for it's already broke as fuck.
I don't like to listen to them at all because their concept of a precious antique is so, I think, unrealistic for the rest of us peons down here on Earth. You find a lot of people who they think of the concept of precious in dollar signs, which I think a lot of our good old-fashioned working-class antiques enthusiasts, we probably all have kind of a different sense of what makes an antique precious.
That's also a dangerous bar to set in an era where antiques prices are plummeting.
The one good point is that there's a line of sentimentality. You're going to have to, like, drop your morals at the door, so to speak, because, you know, unfortunately we live in capitalism and it's going to be a factor. You know, but you know what I mean when I say, like, I think that he has different definition of what's worth preserving than I do.
Almost assuredly.
Yeah, which is why I don't like to listen to them when they speak. I like to, they feel like aliens. And I'm not even just saying this because, like, oh, everyone always goes with it, well, you're just jealous. Like, of course I'm jealous. But I've also, like, I've also met a lot of, like, this kind of person in real life, and I guarantee you that, like, person behind a rubber Spock mask feeling doesn't go away in real life.
What percentage of your experience in antiques would you say has been working with interior designers?
Solid 25%.
Damn.
And I think they're fabulous for the most part. Let me get that straight.
Shout out to our interior design listener.
Well, I think it's great. I really love to see what interior designers can do with a space. I think it's interesting. I think they've got an excellent point when they talk about not cluttering everything. But this is just bad design. The woman, Marie Kondo.
Yes.
Is functionally an interior designer.
Oh. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, I don't know if she is by trade.
She does tend to end up designing interiors.
Yes, yes, but she has a really, like, she has a really moldable sensibility about it. She understands that an interior means something different to everyone else. There was that one, my favorite episode, with the pinball machines. And she said, you know, oh, no, the pinball machines make you happy. You don't have to get rid of them. But we have to figure out a way to display them that makes you even happier. Which is like, that's interior design to me. This is like a sidebar, but the painting the walls white thing with like real estate, I understand it on this like functional level because the human brain is bad at pictures and like, and it needs help.
It needs help imagining what the space could look like when confronted with the image of what the space is like.
Yeah, yeah, but I like digital staging for that because I know very few people who moved into a space and didn't immediately paint over the white. Because it's not the white you want, you just need the white because your brain is bad at making imagines. Like, that's not a personal indictment, we all are bad at it. That's why we like to look at the white first and then go, yes, purple. Or, you know, whatever. I mean, I actually do enjoy a white.
I don't.
In some, I like a trim, I like a trim. I actually like a white accent wall, if that makes any sense.
Paint it black.
Like, I do the absolute opposite of every, like, everyone's like, oh, you get one bright accent wall. Like, oh, you get one white accent wall.
Counterpoint, lime green, black trim.
That's good, too. I still want, like, a white square for, like, artwork. So that the colors get preserved.
No. Wait, counterpoint. Should come out, counterpoint. Black walls, lime green trim.
No, no, I actually, I'm not, goth as hell, but no. No, no, a buddy of ours painted the showroom black, and it's horrendous. I hate it.
Is it really?
Oh, it's so awful. It really does kill, like, the light. And I like light more than I like the concept of black. Without the light, I can't enjoy all the black.
You need the light to cast the shadow.
Oh, thank you, Tolkien. Sorry, I know we already talked about this, but this line specifically really, really, like, hit the core. There's the fashion element where things do cycle through periodically, but there's another trajectory, which is life becoming increasingly less formal, she said. For the last 300 years, it's been a downward trend. Oh, I can't imagine why! Why would I become less formal when I literally do not own a home?
It's almost as though formality is cost money.
Almost as if.
It's almost as if we can't afford a valet. Or a valet, even.
Almost, or cleaners. Like, a maid, yes. Yes, things have become freakishly informal since I work 12 hours a day. I do sometimes eat a Burger King burger in my car.
It's almost as if not being able to afford the expense of the groceries required to serve a dinner party, much less the time to cook for one, has impeded my ability to throw dinner parties in a dedicated dining room.
They specifically at some point out that people want smaller, useful pieces, and it's like, think for 5 seconds. Why? And it's not because people inherently hate credenzas. It's not because anyone grew up and said, oh man, the credenza made me want to kill.
I mean, in my case it did, but go on.
That's a personal problem. I can't imagine being that short-sighted that I wouldn't at some point sit down and go, now there's gotta be a different explanation for this rather than raging hatred. Like, yeah, formality is a luxury. Sorry. We would all love to have a dining room that all we did is eat in. But that's not life right now for most of us. I don't know a single person who has a dining room that isn't also a workshop of some kind. Scratch that. I know about 2 people that own a dining room.
I was gonna say, this apartment does not contain a dining room. It contains a living room that is also my roommate's art studio because we turned a 1-bedroom into a 2-bedroom.
I know.
Because neither of us can afford a 1-bedroom on our own.
All the people I know with a dining room are also over 50. So make of that what you will.
It's almost as though the minimum wage stagnated.
Mm.
Anyway.
It's just, okay, but like, so the thesis here is that there's an element of class, like,
very strongly so.
Like a very strong element of class that none of these articles take into account, which it just seems awful. It seems really, if what you're doing is reporting, then I'm sorry, but I think you did a bad job.
Speaking of rage.
Yes, I'm so acquainted with the idea.
According to interior designer Christina Murphy, speaking to the New York Times, proportion is also important. To keep a room feeling young and fresh, she advised keeping antiques to less than 25% of the furniture. It definitely can't start inching toward the 50, she said. But it's so case by case. Art Deco looks so modern. But one bad Victorian thing can ruin a whole view. Then you have to go to like 3%.
You own a bad Victorian thing.
Also, I fucking wish 3% of my furniture was Victorian.
Yeah, well...
I wish 100% of my furniture was Victorian. Yeah. You Philistine!
Yeah, there's that again, huh?
I think that's bonkers. I think it's kind of insane to say things like, it's a case-by-case basis, but here's, like, a hard and fast percentage. You're going to have to pick one or the other eventually now, aren't you, darling? I just love the idea that if you have one ugly Victorian piece, all the other antiques are ruined. I mean, interior design is supposed to be a very personal thing, right? Shouldn't the percentage of antiques in your home be exactly the amount that you want?
Not if you're trying to sell the space.
Again, like, I can't tell you enough. There's a new castle storage opening up on every corner every week. Like, is it becoming... is it becoming more common to sell your home as an estate?
Possibly.
Is that the problem here? Is that I'm out of touch and everyone's selling their furniture with their home now?
I'm not a doctor, man. I can't tell you.
25%. The Victorians ruin everything. Go home. You had this butt ugly Victorian side table, and now you have to downsize your whole collection. Hey, so again, I'm just going to preface this by saying this is like totally subjective, purely emotional. There's a part in the one about if antiques will die forever, about where they say, like, contemporary is our fastest growing category. Now, could it be?
Because new contemporary stuff is being made every day?
Could it be because the past is finite? And yet the future is ever marching forward.
Now, D.
Does that, I mean, like, am I crazy here for thinking, like, that's a wild thing to say? Is like, yes, the future is constantly growing. I suppose you're correct. Did they mean to say modern? Which does have a distinct, like...
No, they meant contemporary. It's new stuff being produced by new designers.
All contemporary means is that it was made that year. So yeah, I guess the years do... The years start coming and they don't stop coming.
And they don't stop coming?
And yet the Regency period is so limited.
To the Regency?
Like maybe I'm reading it wrong, but that was really frustrating.
Oh, yes. Contemporary pieces such as... A pair of black plywood benches sprouting moose antlers by the fashion designer Rick Owens.
I bet that has something to do with their price.
For $5,500. And, like, honestly, I would be into it if it weren't for the plywood.
Yeah, I think the plywood's a little cheap. Like, I think for $5,000 you should have sold me some hardwood.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is that the future is so... now. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I suppose. Technically, yes, yeah. It will probably continue to grow, you'll find.
So, according to Colin Stair, the owner of Stair Galleries Auction House in Hudson, New York, as quoted in the New York Times, prices for average pieces are now 80% off.
I would love... You know, when you say things and it becomes published, you have to justify it a little.
Here's the thing. 80% off of $1,000 is still $200, and I can't afford that.
Almost as if.
It has to be 90% off before I consider adjusting my grocery budget to make it happen.
But Ken, I don't see how that could have impacted the value of antiques. Or why the contemporary category just seems to keep growing. And yet you never see any new Victorian pieces. It's all very mysterious. When will it swing back?
Now... You mentioned contemporary versus modern, and that does bring me to the one spot of hope in these two articles for me personally. And that is, quote, the market for mid-century modern furniture without a recognizable name attached, popular just a few years ago, is also flagging.
Yeah, it's a trend.
Unless it's special, has a name brand, or is sexy, it'll die just as hard as a piece of brown Georgian furniture.
I want two points. Sexy and also die.
Listen. For those of you who are new to the podcast, I'm the one who wants modern furniture to die.
I think it definitely has its place.
I'm the one who despises mid-century modern furniture. Please direct all of your hate mail to KenAntiquesFreaksPodcast@gmail.com.
I know you have a friend in me. I understand.
D is with you. I am not. I respect you, but I am not with you.
He will fight you. He respects you, but he will throw hands. Well, that was that thing about the winter market, right? And how the winter market very... I didn't know this, actually.
Oh, yes. According to the New York Times, even New York's prestigious winter antiques show has changed its rules. Founded in 1955, the show once required that exhibited pieces be at least 100 years old. In 2009, the organizers and dealer committee changed the cutoff date to 1969 to include mid-century objects. In 2016, they removed the date restriction entirely, paving the way for contemporary design.
That's the part,
The winter antiques show is no longer antiques.
That's the thing, right? Like, okay, so, I mean, how do you feel about that change?
Angry. Right. I didn't even know the winter antiques show existed and I'm angry.
I mean, I knew about it, but I don't like being in New York, so... Only when I'm with my dear sweet New York friends. But, like, other than that, New York is, well, let's call it a stressful place.
Now, to return to the quote, you'll note that it is the year of 2009 when the Winter Antiques show decided it needed to include mid-century objects.
Yeah.
When was Mad Men on the air?
I have no idea, but, you know, I think it was roundabouts.
Anyway...
Mad Men is not mid-century. Wait, yes it is. I'm sorry.
D?
I was thinking, I was thinking about Boardwalk Empire.
I have some bad news for you. Those are different shows.
I watched neither. And they both have these male actors that I detest, so they've just gotten...
What did Steve Buscemi ever do?
He's the only good one. I mean, not the character. The character, as I understand, is horrendous.
The character is awful. Michael K. Williams, on the other hand.
Absolutely dreamy. Ha. Michael K. Williams. What I wouldn't do for a credenza with him on top.
Listen, we all have dreams.
But it's just, words have meaning, right? I mean, last time I checked, that, like, I understand, I totally agree with opening up the definition of antiques. I do think that, A, it's a squidgy definition, and B, 100 is incredibly limiting.
Whoa. Sharp turnaround from definitions episode.
You know, yeah, well, yeah, because we can be wrong. And also, the definitions episode is generally accepted, not fact. Because there's no fact.
It's also 100 years old at this point, really. Podcast time.
Yeah, in podcast years. we didn't even talk about Fortnite in that episode. It's dead. It's over. And yet, the contemporary episodes, why, it's our fastest growing category.
New episodes is our fastest growing category episodes.
It seems episodes that we are making are the fastest growing category. God help me. What the fuck was I just saying?
Antiques good. Antiques.
Well, duh.
Antiques good. Mid-century.
Oh, okay. Yes, opening up the definition from 100 years. Obviously, 100 years is very, like, limiting. That cuts out the 19... Well, it did. I can't do the math, but it cut out the 1920s for quite a while. I actually think the 1920s are coming due now, aren't they?
Yes, because it is almost 2020.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, for years and years, it cut out the 1920s and the 1930s and the 1940s, which they aren't technically 100 years old, but generally accepted as antiques.
Lord knows a lot of people want Art Deco to be antique.
Well, it is. I mean...
Bitter.
For all intents and purposes.
Art Deco leaking into the Art Nouveau and Victorian results.
That's got nothing
to do. Everywhere on the internet. No one has everything to do with it, and I'm going to burn it to the ground.
Well, and now you know that about Kent.
Anything that comes between me and Victorians, I will destroy. I will do my darndest to destroy. And yes, this includes the Jazz Age. And also Mad Men.
I have to stop you at the Jazz Age.
No, I'm going to...
You will not pry the Jazz Age from me.
I'm doing it.
From my gin-soaked, Jake-legged hands.
I'm setting it aflame. Fuck the Jazz Age.
I hate you. No, I'm just kidding.
Thank you for clarifying that you do not, in fact, hate me.
Well, you know, I don't want that going down... As these articles have proven, like, you do have to be factually correct about things.
Do we?
And so rarely are we ever. I can't remember what I was saying again.
Antique shows expanding their definition of antiques.
Oh, that's good.
Other shit.
Yes, but including things that aren't antiques, like, explicitly and ever. Like, that's an art show. And if you wanted an art show, you could have had an art show somewhere else. Like, I don't know what to tell you about that, like, a contemporary piece of art is art and not an antique.
Now, I couldn't help but notice on your recent expedition to Brimfield, it seemed that Brimfield had also expanded its definition of antiques to include LuLaRoe.
Well, Brimfield's whole problem is that it got too big too fast to really set rules. So it's basically if you pay them, you can have what you want, but you won't do well because people are there for antiques. And the LuLaRoe booth was, accordingly, very empty. So that's less of a definitions thing and more of like Brimfield is a huge entity and they can't possibly spend their time policing everything that comes through. So, you know, but you notice that it's not called the Brimfield LuLaRoe show. You know, it's just...
LuLaRoe is our fastest growing market for it.
Oh, God. I feel off. In 100 years, there's going to be so much LuLaRoe as like antique, as like, you know how we have new old stock of
as
like...
vintage.
Yeah, like yeah. The vintage clothing and they're not going to be able to sell a stitch of it.
Because it'll dissolve in your hands.
Yeah, well, this thing is actually, now that I think about it, we won't have any. It's not garments made to last. Yeah, I don't know. New York Winter Show is a huge, it's like a precedent defining, like, all the big moves happen, like in, you know, Sotheby's and Christie's also, all those big moves. And then you say, okay, now it's an art show. And then you go, hey, wait, why isn't anyone here for our antiques? Well, I don't know. Possibly because you've redirected the attention off of them in a major way. Because you changed the timbre of your entire show, but now you're just sitting there going, well, I guess they just don't like the antiques.
Counterpoint. Did they change when they noticed that people were no longer interested in antiques?
Well, then shut the show down and open a different one. I don't, like...
And lose brand recognition?
But you can't just You can't say, oh, this is an antique show, and also you can pick up some corn dogs.
Are you saying that I can't turn this into a corn dogs podcast?
I would love nothing more. But, you know, we can have a side corn dog podcast.
Donate to our Patreon. Make it possible.
I'm just saying, if you have an antique show and I show up and it's mostly contemporary art that I, A, can't afford and B, already have no interest in because I showed up for your antique show, and then I stop going, you get one guess as to why I stopped going. It's not because I don't like antiques. It's because you tricked me. Yeah, like, brand recognition is important, but you're going to find pretty quickly that it means nothing when you don't provide what the brand promises.
But they are seeing people come back to the show now, and they are seeing people, like, buy and sell shit.
Yeah, art dealers. That's a contemporary going into the hands of an antiques collector.
So you are sticking with your theory that they are taste makers and not taste chasers.
It's not 100%, but I think that has its role in it.
Okay.
Like, I do think that they are, in a way, kind of resculpting the landscape.
Now, how do you feel about the term persistent through both of these articles that was new to me, brown furniture?
I've heard that one before. I hate it.
So this seems to be a term invented by a kindergartner to describe any furniture that is the color of the wood it's made of.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
well,
is brown.
It's like specifically so that, like... it's like a term that specifically exists because I guess some of the older pieces that are made out of like blonde wood, because they're still viable for design, because they're obsessed with the color white for some reason, which is reprehensible. But yeah, brown furniture is like, yeah, if it's brown color, which is a lot of wood, you'll find that's a bulk.
I had never once encountered any antiques person who called it brown furniture. It was always called the type of wood it was made of, or perhaps a more descriptive form of the color. No one was calling it brown furniture.
It's a shorthand that I have used to describe exactly the phenomena that no one wants, like brown wood, that people tend to shy away from, like wood colored woods, so to speak.
Why?
Well, I can't imagine. Maybe because they don't have them at the winter show anymore.
Yeah, no, that's definitely it. Just... The winter show is the source of all of our problems. It's true.
Well, because it's not hip, is it? It's not hip. It's very hard to... it is hard to coordinate color with certain kinds of, like, wood. You know, mahogany pretty famously doesn't go with a lot of colors that you might like. So, yeah, there is an extent to which I understand that you need to have a specific kind of, like, taste to make these things work. But yeah, a brown wood is a term. Sorry. I don't like it either, but I actually can't think of a better one. Because you do have to leave out blonde wood, because blonde wood's like this entirely different entity. And ebony and teak, and all, well, teak is brown. But like ebony wood. To an extent, black walnut. But black walnut's still pretty brown.
And anachronistic.
Entirely. To every period. If you've ever seen
No one has ever made furniture out of black walnut. It's just a science fact.
If you've ever seen a black walnut tree, I'm sorry to say.
It doesn't exist.
You were wrong.
It's not real.
It's never happened. And on the next episode of The Twilight Zone.
I think that's the deepest cut we've ever made.
The Twilight Zone?
No, the black walnut.
Oh. Yeah, it's so deep that we're literally not going to talk about the source.
We're never going to explain it. Find it on your own.
It's an inside joke, and now you have to listen to it. I thought you were saying the Twilight Zone. I was going to be really aggrieved if nobody, if people are like actually removed from the Twilight Zone.
No, no one who listens to an antiques podcast has ever heard of the Twilight Zone. Okay, so final shrieks into the void regarding these articles.
I think these articles do more to hurt the industry than they do anything else.
Really?
I think that they are constantly pushing this narrative that it's all worthless, it's all going to hell. And I think that pushes interest away. Because again, nothing exists in a vacuum, and the bigger... New York Times is a pretty big thing, and like when they're talking about it in this disparaging way, even if the message at the core of it is, well, maybe you should still like them, I still think that like the general vibe is like, well, you better not bother with this. Especially when you get money involved, when you start describing it as a money sink, I think you're really turning people off.
I was a little horrified at the couple who was buying antiques as investment pieces and then found that they had lost a considerable sum in doing that because the pieces were worth about 10% of what they'd paid.
But that comes up so often when you're talking about like, oh, are antiques worth it? Can you name me a single investment property that hasn't had a major downturn? It's not unique to antiques.
It's almost as though investments are inherently risky.
Like, imagine if the dot-com boom happened and people were like, oh, will the internet ever recover? You'd sound like an idiot. Because you would be an idiot. Because, like, an investment is a risk. I think it might be part of the definition. Like, yeah, of course an antiques investment will be a risk. But everything is. Real estate, art.
Except Beanie Babies.
Beanie Babies are solid. I can't, but Beanie Babies will never let you down. Go buy them.
Buy them right now.
Oh, I saw another collection on Facebook for $20,000.
Oh, no.
Oh, it was painful to look at.
Poor babies, literally.
So, yeah, again, I don't think it would behoove these people to mention that, yeah, buying things in as an investment, you are standing to lose. Because it's different from culturing, like, a love, a respect, an appreciation. And a sense of aesthetic, even, if you want to be sort of soulless about it. How about you?
Do you feel that the antiques market has, in fact, bottomed out?
Oh, totally. The problem, a lot of my rage comes to the fact that they're not wrong. Things are bad, but I don't think that it's bottomed out because of anything inherent to the antiques industry. I think that it's bottomed out because a lot of things have bottomed out.
Because we, as millennials, have killed every market?
Yeah,
With our lack of money?
Maliciously. Yeah, no. No, I just think that, like... Things are bad right now, and unfortunately it's having an impact on a lot of stuff. You know, I think if you talk to artisans, you're going to get a really similar response. Because the demand for artisan goods, they have to charge a lot to survive. It's just not viable right now. And like I said, that's a lot of industries, so I think blaming antiques for the antiques bottoming out is short-sighted. And I think that's a blinkering to a lot of class and, like, income problems that are... Oh, just becoming increasingly harder to ignore.
It's a very Donna Tartt way of looking at it, of saying that, like, the reason people don't appreciate beautiful things is because they have no class. Instead of, like, we love the beautiful things, but we can't fucking afford them.
It's unattainable, and you've made them unattainable. Like, it's just, I can't, like, again, obviously my arguments for this are intensely flawed, but there is something to the idea of people dangling something out of reach and saying, well, why doesn't anyone have it? Like, yeah, I can't imagine why.
Why aren't we buying houses?
And it just, is it just me, or, like, is antiques the one industry that people are talking about where they're really stubbornly, almost willfully ignoring the issue?
That might be the classism inherent to the antiques business.
Yeah, that sucks. Because you know, people have confronted it with the housing market, saying, oh, this might be because they don't have money, not because they don't like being in a living space.
No, as a millennial, I hate the security of knowing where I'll be able to live for the next 20 years.
It disgusts me. Oh, mama, I was born a rambling man. Can't tie me down. So, yeah, I mean, what are your other final thoughts? Questions, concerns, just want to yell at.
If New York City antiques designers and interior designers and what have you want me to buy their antiques, they should give me money that I can use to buy the antiques. Because right now, I don't have any.
Yeah, have you considered hiring me?
Money, please.
It will possibly put me in a
position. Dollars.
I'm surprised we're not talking about the interior design industry can't possibly be doing well. The downturn in the housing market. A lot of people asking to have their studios furnished, I think? No.
In New York City?
Well, in New York City, because a studio is, you know, that's
a lifelong investment.
Yeah, because it's a different economy there, almost as if. New York Times, it's almost as if it's different there. Sorry, just very salty about the things that have been said.
And thank you to listener Holly for sending us these articles.
Yeah, thank you, Holly. I hope this is the reaction you were looking for.
I hope this was the hour-long shrieking session that you dreamed of.
Well, I mean, I had fun, and that's what this podcast is for primarily, so...
There we go.
I hope you did, too.
Sources for this episode include the New York Times.
For better or worse.
The article, How Low Will Market for Antiques Actually Go? And the article, When the Antiques Have to Go? Now, you can read these on the New York Times website. However, you can only read one per browsing session. And if you want to read the other one, you will have to clear your cache and then open the other one. You cannot have both of these articles open at the same time because they have such aggressive, I don't know what it is, like detection on their site.
It's impressive.
Where if you are trying to see more than one article per browsing session, or even trying to open it on a private browsing tab, they will block the entire article with a message for you to sign up for a free account with them. On the one hand, the account is free. On the other hand, I don't want them telling me anything other than what I specifically want them to tell me. So I don't want to sign up for their unsubscribable email mailing list. What I will be instead doing is opening one article, printing it, clearing my browser cache, printing the second article, rather than trying to read both at once on an internet device.
Wow.
Not that I'm bitter.
Not that you have any opinions on the matter.
When you make me go to fucking Office Max to make a podcast episode, I get pissed.
About a news article online.
Oh, God. If you would like to send us other beautifully infuriating news articles, or just want to say hello, you can email us at antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com. Or you can hit us up on Facebook at facebook.com/antiquesfreaks. And join our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends.
Which I hope has actually been really edifying. I see a lot of people helping other people with the identification. And it's really cool. I like to see people be friends about antiques.
Post your collections.
Yeah, we love to see it. God, I love it.
Show us your antiques. Show us your vintage goods.
And show us your freaks.
Speaking of vintage goods, you can purchase some at our Etsy at etsy.com/shop/antiquesfreaks, which should have some fun new mystery items.
Mystery items.
In the next couple weeks.
Oh boy.
Stay tuned. And while we're on the subject of begging for your feedback.
Ah, yes. My favorite subject. If you like us at all or ever have, please scroll on down to wherever you're listening to this podcast and give us a review, any kind. I've previously been soliciting for 5-star reviews, but at this point I'll take whatever. Any review helps. That's how we get the word out. It gets our smooth voices in more ears.
It convinces the algorithm that we're worth listening to.
Yeah. So it's really cool and fun, and all the cool kids are doing it. I think most top interior designers in New York are saying to rate our podcast.
Are they?
Yes. New York Times has 8 articles titled "Why You Should Listen to This Podcast Specifically, Just This One." This one that specifically disparaged us for about an hour.
New York Times is completely staffed with masochists.
Yes. Hurt me more, Snake.
Dino.
just as an addendum, I think I speak for both of us when I say we really appreciate the suggestions. Because sometimes we're racking our brains for like, God, what are we going to do next? A suggestion is exactly the light in the tunnel I'm looking for.
Yes.
And it's also nice knowing that I am doing something for someone. So please don't feel shy about sending those in.
We'll have at least one listener.
At least one person enjoyed this episode.
Now, if you enjoyed it enough to perhaps give us money on Patreon, we have a Patreon.
And we do have an option for that.
Patreon.com/antiquesfreaks, where you can listen to deleted scenes and join the Random Vintage Postcard of the Month Club, where we send you a random vintage postcard every month.
It's quite fun.
Christmas postcards optional.
You know how, like, those unboxing things? Except it's much cheaper and there's less garbage in your home.
Yes. Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and getting us ever closer to our goal of releasing bonus episodes.
So close.
So near.
We
so
love you. Near. We love all of you.
And thank you, specifically, for listening.
That's right, you.
Goodbye.
Bye.